case here, lest you run into some fool who'll kill you for it." Sibel shivered with obvious fear.
"Benji, I'll go with you."
"No, that would be most unwise," I said. "He can get away from anyone much faster without you."
"Oh, so right you are," said Benji, taking the last drag from his cigarette and then crushing it out in a big glass ashtray beside the bed, where a dozen other little white butts were curled waiting for it. "And how many times do I tell her that when I go out for cigarettes in the middle of the night? Does she listen?"
He was off without waiting for an answer. I heard the rush of water from the tap. He was washing away half the cocaine. I let my eyes roam the room, veering away from the soft, blood-filled guardian angel.
"There are people innately good," I said, "who want to help others. You are one of them, Sibel. I won't rest as long as you live. I'll be at your side. I'll be there always to guard you and to repay you."
She smiled. I was astonished. Her lean face, with its well-shaped pale lips, broke into the freshest and most robust smile, as if neglect and pain had never gnawed at her.
"You will be a guardian angel to me, Armand?" she asked.
"Always."
"I'm off," Benji declared. With a crackle and snap, he lit another cigarette. His lungs must have been charcoal sacks.
"I'm going out into the night. But what if this son of a bitch is sick or dirty or—"
"Means nothing to me. Blood's blood. Just bring him here. Don't try this fancy tripping with your foot. Wait till you have him right here beside the bed. And as he reaches to lift the cover, you, Sibel, pull it back, and you, Benji, push on him with all your might, so the side of the bed trips his shins, and he'll fall into my arms. And after that, I'll have him."
He headed for the door.
"Wait," I whispered. What was I thinking of in my greed?
I looked up at her mute, smiling face, and then at him, the little engine puffing away on the black cigarette, with nothing on for the fierce winter outside but the damned jalaba.
"No, it has to be done," said Sibel with wide eyes.
"And Benji will choose a very bad man, won't you, Benji? An evil man who wants to rob and kill you."
"I know where to go," said Benji with a little twisted smile. "Just play your cards when I come back, both of you. Cover him up, Sibel. Don't look at the clock. Don't worry about me."
Off he went with the slam of the door, the big heavy lock slipping shut behind him automatically. So it was coming. Blood, thick red blood, it was coming. It was coming, and it would be hot and delicious, and there would be a man full of it, and it was coming within seconds. I closed my eyes, and opening them, I let the room take shape again with its sky-blue draperies on every window, hanging down in rich folds to the floor, and the carpet a great writhing oval of cabbage roses. And she, this stalk of a girl, staring at me and smiling her simple, sweet smile, as if the crime of the night would be nothing to her. She came down on her knees next to me, perilously close, and again she touched my hair with delicate hand. Her soft, unfettered breasts touched my arm. I read her thoughts as if I read her palm, pushing back through layer after layer of her conscious, seeking the dark, winding road again, whipping and turning through the Jordan Valley, and the parents driving too fast for the pitch dark and the hairpin curves, and the Arab drivers who came on plunging at even greater speed, so that each meeting of headlamps became a grueling contest.
"To eat the fish from the Sea of Galilee," she said,
her eyes drifting away from me.
"I wanted it. It was my idea we go there. We had one more day in the Holy Land, and they said it's a long drive from Jerusalem to Nazareth, and I said, 'But he walked on the water.' It was to me always the strangest tale. You know it?"
"I do," I said.
"That he was walking right on the water, as if he'd forgotten the apostles were there, or that anyone might see him. And they from the boat said, 'Lord,' and he was startled. Such a strange miracle, as if it was all accidental. I was the one who wanted to go. I was the one who wanted to eat the fresh fish right out of the sea, the same water that Peter and the others had fished. It was my doing. Oh, I don't say it was my fault that they died. It was my doing. And we were all headed home for my big night at Carnegie Hall, and the record company was set up to record it live. I'd made a recording before, you know. It had done much better than anyone ever expected. But that night, this night that never happened, that is, I was going to play the Appassionata. It was all that mattered to me. The other sonatas I love, the Moonlight, the Pathétique, but really for me it was the Appassionata. My father and mother were so proud. But my brother, he was the one who always fought, always got me the time, the space, the good piano, the teachers I needed. He was the one who made them see. But then, of course, he didn't have any life at all, and all of us saw what was coming. We'd talk about it round the table at night, that he had to get a life of his own. It was no good his working for me. But then he'd say that I would need him for years to come. I couldn't even imagine. He'd manage the recordings and the performances and the repertory, and the fees we asked. The agents couldn't be trusted. I had no idea, he said, of how high I'd rise.
She paused, cocking her head to one side, her face earnest yet still simple.
It wasn't a decision I made, you understand, she said. I just wouldn't do anything else. They were dead. I just wouldn't go out. I just wouldn't answer the phone. I just wouldn't play anything else. I just wouldn't listen to what he said. I just wouldn't plan. I just wouldn't eat. I just wouldn't change my clothes. I just played the Appassionata.
I understand, I said softly.
He brought Benji back with us to take care of me. I always wondered how. I think Benji was bought, you know, bought with cold cash.
I know. I think that's what happened. He couldn't leave me alone, he said, not even at the King David. That was the hotel. Yes.
Because he said I'd stand in the window without my clothes, or I wouldn't let the maid come in, and I'd play the piano in the middle of the night, and he couldn't sleep. So he got Benji. I love Benji.
I know.
I'd always do what Benji said. He never dared to hit Benji. Only towards the end he started to really hurt me. Before that it was slaps, you know, and kicks. Or he'd pull my hair. He'd grab me by the hair, all my hair in one hand, and he'd throw me down on the floor. He did that often. But he didn't dare to hit Benji. He knew if he hit Benji I'd scream and scream. But then sometimes when Benji would try to make him stop... But I'm not so sure about that, because I would be so dizzy. My head would ache.
I understand, I said. Of course he had hit Benji. She mused quietly, her eyes large still, and so bright, without tears or puckering.
We're alike, you and I, she whispered, looking down at me.
Her hand lay close to my cheek, and she very lightly pressed the soft upper part of her forefinger against me.
Alike? I asked. What in the world can you be thinking of? Monsters, she said. Children.
I smiled, but she didn't smile. She looked dreamy.
I was so glad when you came, she said. I knew he was dead. I knew when you stood at the end of the piano and you looked at me. I knew when you stood there listening to me. I was so happy that there was someone who could kill him.
Do this for me, I said.
What? She asked. Armand, I'll do anything.
Go to the piano now. Play it for me. Play the Appassionata.
But the plan, she asked in a small, wondering voice. The evil man, he's coming.
Leave this to Benji and me. Don't turn around to look. Just play the Appassionata.
No, please, she asked gently.
But why not? I said. Why must you put yourself through such an ordeal?
You don't understand, she said with the widest eyes. I want to see it.
Chapter 22. Benji had just returned below. The distant sound of his voice, quite inaudible to Sibel, instantly drove back the pain from all the surfaces of my limbs.
That's what I mean, you see, he was talking away. It's all underneath the dead body, and we don't want to lift it, the dead body. And you being a cop, you know, you being drug enforcement, they said you would know how to take care of it.
I started to laugh. He had really done himself proud. I looked again at Sibel, who was staring at me with a quiet, resolute expression, one of profound intelligence and reflection.
Push this cover up over my face, I said, and move away, far away. He's bringing us a regular prince of rogues. Hurry.
She snapped into action. I could smell the blood of this victim already, though he was still in the ascending elevator, talking to Benji in low, guarded terms.
And all this you just happened to have in this apartment, you and she? And there's nobody else in on this?
Oh, he was a beauty. I heard the murderer in his voice.
I told you everything,
Benji said in the most natural of little voices. You just help with this, you know. I can't have the police coming in here.
Whisper.
This is a fine hotel. How did I know the guy was going to die here? We don't use this stuff. You take the stuff. Just get the body out of here. Now let me tell you.
The elevator opened to our floor.
This body is pretty messed up, so don't go all slobbering on me when you see it.
Slobbering on you, growled the victim under his breath. Their shoes made soft, hastening sounds on the carpet. Benji fumbled with his keys, pretending to be mixed up.
Sibel, he called out in warning. Sibel, open the door.
Don't do it, I said in a low voice.
Of course not,
came her velvety answer. The barrels of the big lock turned.
And this guy just happens to come up here and die on you with all this stuff.
Well, not exactly, said Benji. But you made a bargain with me. No, I expect you to stick to it.
Look, you little gutter snipe, I didn't make any bargain with you.
Okay, then maybe I call the regular police, then. I know you. Everybody in the bar knows you. Who you are, you're always around. What are you going to do, big shot, kill me?
The door closed behind them. The smell of the man's blood flooded the apartment. He was besotted with brandy, and had the poison cocaine in his veins as well. But none of this would make a particle of difference to my cleansing thirst. I could scarce contain myself. I felt my limbs tighten and try to flex beneath the coverlet.
"Well, isn't she the perfect princess?"
he said, his eyes obviously having fallen on Sibel. Sibel made no answer.
"Never mind her. You look there, under the covers. Sibel, you come here by me. Come on, Sibel."
"Under there? You're telling me the body's under there and the cocaine is under the body?"
"How many times I have to tell you?"
asked Benji, no doubt with his characteristic shrug.
"Look, what part don't you understand, I'd like to know? You don't want this cocaine? I give it away. I'll be very popular in your favorite bar. Come on, Sibel. This man says he will help, then he won't help. Talk, talk, talk. Typical government sleaze."
"Who are you calling a sleaze, kid?"
demanded the man with mock gentleness, the fragrance of the brandy thickening.
"That's some big vocabulary you have for such a little body. How old are you, kid? How the hell did you get into this country? You go around in that nightgown all the time?"
"Yeah, sure, just call me Lawrence of Arabia," said Benji. "Sibel, come over here."
I didn't want her to come. I wanted her as far away from this as possible. She didn't move, and I was very glad of it.
"I like my clothes,"
Benji chattered on, puff of sweet cigarette smoke.
"I should dress like kids in this place, I suppose, in blue jeans? As if. My people dressed like this when Muhammad was in the desert."
"Nothing like progress," said the man with a deep, throaty laugh.
He approached the bed with quick, crisp steps. The scent of blood was so rich, I could feel the pores of my burnt skin opening for it. I used the tiniest part of my strength to form a telepathic picture of him through their eyes. A tall, brown-eyed man, sallow white skin, gaunt cheeks, receding brown hair, in a handmade Italian suit of shining black silk, with flashing diamond cufflinks on his rich linen. He was antsy, fingers working at his sides, almost unable to stand still, his brain a riot of dizzy humor, cynicism, and crazed curiosity. His eyes were greedy and playful. The ruthlessness underscored all, and there seemed in him a strong streak of genuine, drug-nourished insanity. He wore his murders as proudly as he wore his princely suit and the shiny brown boots on his feet. Sibel came near the bed, the sharp, sweet scent of her pure flesh mingling with the heavier, richer scent of the man. But it was his blood I savored, his blood that brought the juices up into my parched mouth. I could barely keep from making a sigh beneath the covers. I felt my limbs about to dance right out of their painful paralysis. The villain was sizing up the place, glancing left and right through open doors, listening for other voices, debating whether he should search this fancy, overstuffed and rambling hotel apartment before he did anything else. His fingers would not be still. In a flash of wordless thought, I caught the quick realization that he'd snorted the cocaine Benji had brought, and he wanted more immediately.
"My, but you are a beautiful young lady," he said to Sibel.
"Do you want me to lift the cover?"
she asked. I could smell the small handgun that was jammed in his high black leather boot, and the other gun, very fancy and modern, a distinctly different collection of metallic scents, in the holster under his arm. I could smell cash on him, too, that unmistakable, stale smell of filthy paper money.
"Come on, you chicken buster?" asked Benji. "You want me to pull back the cover? Say when.
You're going to be real surprised, believe me.
There's no body under there, he said with a sneer. Why don't we sit down and have a little talk? This isn't really your place, is it? I think you children need a little parental guidance.
The body's all burnt up, said Benji. Don't get sick now.
Burnt up, said the man.
It was Sibel's long hand that suddenly whipped the coverlet back. The cool air skidded across my skin. I stared up at the man who drew back, a half-strangled growl caught in his throat.
For the love of God!
My body sprang up, drawn by the plump fountain of blood like a hideous puppet on a score of whipping strings. I flailed against him, then anchored my burnt fingernails hard into his neck, and wrapped the other arm around him in an agonizing embrace, my tongue flashing at the blood that spilled from the claw marks, as I drew in and, ignoring the blazing pain in my face, opened my mouth wide and sank my fangs. Now I had him. His height, his strength, his powerful shoulders, his huge hands clamping to my hurt flesh. None of this could help him. I had him. I drew up the first thick swallow of blood and thought I would swoon. But my body wasn't about to allow it. My body had locked to him as if I were a thing of voracious tentacles. At once, his crazed and luminous thoughts drew me down into a glitzy swirl of New York images, of careless cruelty and grotesque horror, of rampant, drug-driven energy and sinister hilarity. I let the images flood me. I couldn't go for the quick death. I had to have every drop of blood inside him. And for that, the heart must pump and pump. The heart must not give up. If I had ever tasted blood this strong, this sweet and salty, I had no memory of it. There was no way in which memory could record such deliciousness. The absolute rapture of thirst slaked, of hunger cured, of loneliness dissolved in this hot and intimate embrace, in which the sound of my own seething, straining breath would have horrified me if I had cared about it. Such a noise I made, such a dreadful feasting noise. My fingers massaged his thick muscles. My nostrils were pressed into his pampered, soap-scented skin.
Love you. Wouldn't hurt you for the world. You feel it. It's sweet, isn't it?
I whispered to him over the shallows of gorgeous blood.
Yes. So sweet. Better than the finest brandy.
In his shock and disbelief, he suddenly let go utterly, surrendering to the delirium that I stoked with each word. I ripped at his neck, widening the wound, rupturing the artery more fully. The blood gushed anew. An exquisite shiver ran down my back. It ran down the backs of my arms and down my buttocks and legs. It was pain and pleasure commingled as the hot and lively blood forced itself into the microfibers of my shriveled flesh, as it plumped the muscles beneath the roasted skin, as it sank into the very marrow of my bones. More. I had to have more.
"Stay alive. You don't want to die. No, stay alive,"
I crooned, rubbing my fingers up through his hair, feeling that they were fingers now, not the pterodactyl digits they'd been moments before. Oh, they were hot. It was the fire all over again. It was the fire blazing in my scorched limbs. This time death had to come. I couldn't bear this any longer. But a pinnacle had been reached, and now it was past, and a great, soothing ache rushed through me. My face was pumped and teeming, my mouth full again and again, and my throat now swallowing without effort.
"Ah, yes, alive. You're so strong, so wonderfully strong," I whispered. No, don't go. Not yet. It's not time."
His knees buckled. He sank slowly to the carpet, and I with him, pulling him gently over with me against the side of the bed, and then letting him fall beside me, so that we lay like lovers entangled. There was more, much more, more than ever I could have drunk in my regular state, more than ever I could have wanted. Even on those rare occasions when I was a fledgling and greedy and new, and had taken two or three victims a night, I had never drunk so deeply from any one of them. I was now into the dark, tasty dregs, pulling out the very vessels themselves and sweet clots that dissolved on my tongue.
"Oh, you are so precious. Yes, yes."
But his heart could take no more. It was slowing to a lethal, irretrievable pace. I closed my teeth on the skin of his face and ripped it open over his forehead, lapping at the rich tangle of bleeding vessels that covered his skull. There was so much blood here, so much blood behind the tissues of the face. I sucked up the fibers and then spit them out, bloodless and white, watching them drop to the floor like so much slop. I wanted the heart and the brain. I had seen the ancients take it. I knew how. I'd seen the Roman Pandora once reach right into the chest. I went for it. Astonished to see my hand fully formed, though dark brown in color, I made my fingers rigid like a deadly spade and drove it into him, tearing linen and cracking breastbone, and then reaching his soft entrails until I had the heart and held it as I'd seen Pandora hold it. I drank from it. Oh, it had plenty of blood. This was magnificent. I sucked it to pulp and then let it fall. I lay as still as he, at his side, my right hand on the back of his neck, my head bowed against his chest, my breath coming in heavy sighs. The blood danced in me. I felt my arms and legs jerking. Spasms ran through me, so that the sight of his white dead carcass blinkered in my gaze. The room flashed on and off.
"Oh, what a sweet brother," I whispered. "Sweet, sweet brother."
I rolled on my back. I could hear the roar of his blood in my very ears, feel it moving over my scalp, feel it tingling in my cheeks and in the palms of my hands. Oh, good, too lusciously good.
"Bad guy, hmm?"
It was Benji's voice, far away in the world of the living. Far away in another realm where pianos ought to be played, and little boys should dance, they stood, the two like painted cut-out figures against the swimming light of the room, merely gazing at me, he the little desert rogue with his fancy black cigarette, puffing away and smacking his lips and raising his eyebrows, and she merely floating, it seemed, resolute and thoughtful as before, unshocked, untouched, perhaps. I sat up and pulled up my knees. I rose to my feet, with only a quick handhold on the side of the bed to steady myself. I stood naked looking at her. Her eyes were filled with a deep, rich gray light, and she smiled as she looked at me.
"Oh, magnificent," she whispered.
"Magnificent," I said. I lifted my hands and pushed my hair back off my face. "Show me the glass, hurry. I'm thirsting again already." It had begun. This was no lie. In a stupor of shock, I stared into the mirror. I had seen such ruined specimens as this before, but each of us is ruined in our own way, and I, for alchemical reasons I couldn't proclaim, was a dark brown creature, the very perfect color of chocolate, with remarkably white opal eyes set with reddish-brown pupils. The nipples of my chest were black as raisins. My cheeks were painfully gaunt, my ribs perfectly defined beneath my shiny skin. And the veins that were so full of sizzling action, stood like ropes along my arms and the calves of my legs. My hair, of course, had never seemed so lustrous, so full, so much a thing of youth and natural beneficence. I opened my mouth. I ached with thirst. All the awakened flesh sang with thirst, or cursed me with it. It was as if a thousand crushed and muted cells were now chanting for blood. "I have to have more. I have to. Stay away from me." I hurried past Benji, who all but danced at my side.
"What do you want? What can I do? I'll get another one."
"No, I'll get him for myself." I fell on the victim and slipped loose his silk tie. I quickly undid the buttons of his shirt. Benji fell at once to unbuckling his belt. Sibel, on her knees, tugged at his boots. "The gun. Beware of the gun," I said in alarm. "Sibel, back away from him."
"I see the gun," she said reprovingly.
She laid it aside carefully, as if it were a freshly caught fish and might flop from her hands. She peeled off his socks.
"Armand, these clothes," she said. "They're too big."
"Benji, you have shoes?" I asked. "My feet are small." I stood up and hastily put on the shirt, fastening the buttons with a speed that dazzled them. "Don't watch me. Get the shoes," I said. I pulled on the trousers, zipped them up, and with Sibel's quick fingers to help, buckled the flapping leather belt. I pulled it as tight as I could. This would do. She crouched before me, her dress a huge flowered circle of prettiness around her, as she rolled the pant legs over my brown, bare feet. I had slipped my hands through his fancy linked shirt cuffs without ever disturbing them. Benji threw down the black dress shoes, fine ballet pumps, never even worn by him, divine little wretch. Sibel held one sock from my foot. Benji gathered up the other. When I put on the coat, it was done. The sweet tingling in my veins had stopped.
It was pain again. It was beginning to roar, as if I were threaded with fire, and the witch with a needle pulled on the thread hard to make me quiver. A towel, my dears. Something old, common. No, don't. Not in this day and age. Don't think of it. Full of loathing, I gazed down at his livid flesh. He lay staring dully at the ceiling, the soft tiny hair in his nostrils very black against his drained and awful skin, his teeth yellow above his colorless lip. The hair on his chest was a matted swarm in the sweat of his death, and against the giant gaping slit lay the pulp that had been his heart. Ah, this was the evil evidence which must be shut from the eyes of the world on general principles. I reached down and slipped the ruins of his heart back into the cavity of his chest. I spit upon the wound and rubbed it with my fingers. Benji gasped.
"Look at it heal, Sibel," he cried.
"Just barely," I said. "He's too cold, too empty." I looked about. There lay the man's wallet, papers, a bag in leather, lots of green bills and a fancy silver clip. I gathered all this up. I stuffed the folded money in one pocket and all else in the other. What else did he have? Cigarette, a deadly switchblade knife, and the guns. Ah, yes, the guns. Into my coat pockets I put these items. Swallowing my nausea, I reached down and scooped him up, horrid flaccid white man in his pitiable silk shorts and fancy gold wristwatch. My old strength was indeed coming back. He was heavy, but I could easily heave him over my shoulder.
"What will you do? Where will you go?"
Sibel cried.
"Armand, you can't leave us."
"You will come back," said Benji. "Here, give me that watch. Don't throw away that man's watch."
"Shh, Benji," Sibel whispered. "You know damned good and well I've bought you the finest watches. Don't touch him. Armand, what can we do now to help you?"
She drew close to me.
"Look,"
she said, pointing to the dangling arm of the corpse, which hung just below my right elbow.
"He has manicured nails. How amazing!"
"Oh, yeah, he always took very good care of himself," said Benji. "You know the watch is worth $5,000."
"Hush up about the watch," she said. "We don't want his things."
She looked at me again.
"Armand, even now you're still changing. Your face, it's getting fuller."
"Yes, and it hurts," I said. "Wait for me. Prepare a dark room for me. I'll come back as soon as I've fed. I have to feed now. Feed and feed to heal the scars that are left. Open the door for me." "Let me see if there's anyone out there," said Benji, with a quick, dutiful rush to the door. I went out into the hallway, easily carrying the poor corpse, its white arms hanging down, swinging and banging against me just a little. What a sight I was in these big clothes! I must have looked like a mad, poetical schoolboy who had raided the thrift stores for the finest threads, and was off now in fancy new shoes to search out the rock bands.
"There isn't anyone out here, my little friend," I said. "It's 3 o'clock and the hotel's asleep. And if reason serves me right, that's the door of the fire stairs there, at the very end of the hall, correct? There isn't anyone in the fire stairs either."
"Oh, clever Armand, you delight me," he said. He narrowed his little black eyes. He jumped up and down soundlessly on the hallway carpet.
"Give me the watch," he whispered.
"No," I said. "She's right. She's rich, and so am I. And so are you. Don't be a beggar."
"Armand, we'll wait for you," said Sibel in the doorframe. "Benji, come inside immediately."
"Oh, listen to her now, how she wakes up, how she talks. Benji, come inside," she says. "Hey, sweetheart, don't you have something to do just now? Like, perhaps play the piano?" She gave a tiny burst of laughter in spite of herself. I smiled. What a strange pair they were. They did not believe their own eyes. But that was typical enough in this century. I wondered when they would start to see, and having seen, start screaming. "Goodbye, sweet loves," I said. "Be ready for me."
"Armand, you will come back."
Her eyes were full of tears.
"You promise me."
I was stunned. "Sibel," I said, "what is it that women want so often to hear and wait so long to hear it? I love you." I left them, racing down the stairs, hefting him to the other shoulder when the weight on the one side became too hurtful. The pain passed over me in waves. The shock of the outside cold air was scalding. "Feed," I whispered. And what was I to do with him? He was far too naked to carry down Fifth Avenue. I slipped off his watch because it was the only identification on him left,
and almost vomiting with revulsion from my closeness to these fetid remains. I dragged him by one hand after me very fast through the back alley, and then across a small street and down another sidewalk. I ran into the face of the icy wind, not stopping to observe those few hulking shapes that hobbled by in the wet darkness, or to take stock of the one car that crept along on the shining wet asphalt. Within seconds I had covered two blocks, and finding a likely alleyway with a high gate to keep out the beggars of the night, I quickly mounted the bars and flung his carcass to the very far end of it. Down into the melting snow he fell. I was rid of him. Now I had to have blood. There was no time for the old game, the game of drawing out those who wanted to die, those who truly craved my embrace, those in love already with the far country of death, of which they knew nothing. I had to shuffle and stumble along, the mark, in my floppy silk jacket and rolled pants, long hair veiling my face. Poor, dazzled kid, perfect for your knife, your gun, your fist. It didn't take long. The first was a drunken, sauntering wretch who plied me with questions before he revealed the flashing blade and went to sink it into me. I pushed him up against the side of the building and fed like a glutton. The next was a common, desperate youth, full of festering sores, who had killed twice before for the heroin he needed as badly as I needed the doomed blood inside him. I drank more slowly. The thickest, worst scars of my body yielded with much defense, itching, throbbing, and only slowly melting away. But the thirst would not stop. My bowels churned as if devouring themselves. My eyes pulsed with pain. But the cold, wet city, so full of rankling, hollow noise, grew ever brighter before me. I could hear voices many blocks away, and small electronic speakers in high buildings. I could see beyond the breaking clouds the true and numberless stars. I was almost myself again. So who will come to me now, I thought, in this barren, desolate hour before dawn, when the snow is melting in the warmer air, and neon lights have all died out, and the wet newspaper blows like leaves through a stripped and frozen forest. I took all the precious articles which had belonged to my first victim, and dropped them here and there into deep, hollow public trash cans. One last killer, yes, please, fate, do give me this, while there's time. And indeed he came, blasted fool, out of a car, as behind him the driver waited, the motor idling. "What's taking you so damn long?" said the driver at last. "Nothing," I said, dropping his friend. I leaned in to look at him. He was as vicious and stupid as his companion. He threw up his hand, but helplessly and too late. I pushed him over on the leather seat and drank now for rank pleasure, pure, sweet, crazed pleasure. I walked slowly through the night, my arms out, my eyes directed heavenward. From the scattered black grates of the gleaming street there gushed the pure white steam of heated places below. Trash in shiny plastic sacks made a fantastical, modern, and glittering display on the curbs of the slate-gray sidewalks. Tiny, tender trees, with little year-round leaves like short pen-strokes of bright green in the night, bent their stem-like trunks with the whining wind. Everywhere the high, clean glass doors of granite-faced buildings contained the radiant splendor of rich lobbies. Shop windows displayed their sparkling diamonds, lustrous furs, and smartly cut coats and gowns on grandly coiffed and faceless pewter mannequins. The cathedral was a lightless, soundless place of frost-rimmed turrets and ancient, pointed arches, the pavement clean where I had stood on the morning where the sun caught me. Lingering there, I closed my eyes, trying perhaps to recall the wonder and the zeal, the courage and the glorious expectation. There came instead, clear and shining through the dark air, the pristine notes of the Appassionata. Rolling, rumbling, racing on, the crashing music came to call me home. I followed it. The clock in the hotel foyer was striking 6. The winter dark would break up in moments, like the very ice that had once imprisoned me. The long polished desk was deserted in the muted lights. In a wall mirror of dim glass, framed in rococo gold, I saw myself, paled and waxen and unblemished. Oh, what fun the sun and ice had had with me in turns, the fury of the one, quick frozen by the merciless grip of the other. Not a scar remained of where the skin had burnt to muscle.
a sealed and solid thing with seamless agony within, I was, all of a piece, restored, with sparkling clear white fingernails and curling lashes round my clear brown eyes, and clothes a wretched heap of stained, misfitted finery on the old familiar rugged cherub. Never before had I been thankful to see my own too youthful face, too hairless chin, too soft and delicate hands, but I could have thanked the gods of old for wings at this moment. Above, the music carried on, so grand, so legible of tragedy and lust and dauntless spirit. I loved it so. Who in the whole wide world could ever play that same sonata as she did, each phrase as fresh as songs sung all their livelong life by birds, who know but one such set of patterns? I looked about. It was a fine, expensive place, of old wainscoting and a few deep chairs, and door keys ranged up a wall in tiny, dark-stained wooden boxes. A great vase of flowers, the infallible trademark of the vintage New York hotel, stood boldly and magnificently in the middle of the space, atop a round black marble table. I skirted the bouquet, snapping off one big pink lily with a deep red throat and petals curling to yellow at the outside, and then I went silently up the fire stairs to find my children. She did not stop her playing when Benji let me in. "You're looking really good, Angel," he said. On and on she went, her head moving unaffectedly and perfectly with the rhythm of the sonata. He led me through a chain of finely decorated, plastered chambers. "Mine was too sumptuous by far," I whispered, seeing the tapestry spread and pillows of old, gracious, threadbare gold. I needed only perfect darkness. "But this is the least we have," he said with a little shrug. He had changed to a fresh white linen robe, lined with a fine blue stripe, a kind I'd often seen in Arab lands. He wore white socks with his brown sandals. He puffed his little Turkish cigarette and squinted up at me through the smoke. "You brought me back the watch, didn't you?" He nodded his head, all sarcasm and amusement. "No," I said. I reached into my pocket. "But you may have the money. Tell me, since your little mind is such a locket and I have no key, did anyone see you bring that badge-carrying, gun-toting villain up here?"
"I see him all the time," he said with a little weary wave of his hand. "We left the bar separately. I killed two birds with one stone. I'm very smart."
"How so?" I asked. I put the lily in his little hand.
"Sibel's brother bought from him. That cop was the only guy ever missed him."
He gave a little laugh. He tucked the lily in the thick curls above his left ear, then pulled it down and twirled its tiny ciborium in his fingers.
"Clever, no? Now nobody asks where he is."
"Oh, indeed. Two birds with one stone, you're quite right," I said, "though I'm sure there's a great deal more to it."
"But you'll help us now, won't you?"
"I will indeed. I'm very rich, I told you. I'll patch things up. I have an instinct for it. I owned a great playhouse in a faraway city, and after that an island of fancy shops and other such things. I am a monster in many realms, it seems. You will never, ever have to fear again."
"You're truly beautiful, you know,"
he said, raising one eyebrow and then giving me a quick wink. He drew on his tasty-looking little cigarette and then offered it to me. His left hand kept the lily safe. "Can't only drink blood," I said. "A regular vampire out of the book in the main. Need deep darkness in the light of day, which is coming very soon. You mustn't touch this door."
"Ha!" he laughed with impish delight. "That's what I told her."
He rolled his eyes and glanced in the direction of the living room.
"I said we had to steal a coffin for you right away, but she said, 'No, you'd think of that.'"
"How right she was. The room will do, but I like coffins well enough, I really do."
"And can you make us vampires, too?"
"Oh, never, absolutely not. You're pure of heart and too alive, and I don't have such a power. It's never done, it can't be." Again he shrugged.
"Then who made you?" he asked.
"I was born out of a black egg," I said. "We all are." He gave a scoffing laugh. "Well, you've seen all the rest," I said. "Why not believe the best part of it?" He only smiled and puffed his smoke and looked at me most knavishly. The piano sang on in crashing cascades, the rapid notes melting as fast as they were born, so like the last thin snowflakes of the winter, vanishing before they strike the pavements. "May I kiss her before I go to sleep?" I asked. He cocked his head and shrugged. "If she doesn't like it, she'll never stop playing long enough to say so." I went back into the parlor. How clear it all was! The grand design of sumptuous French landscapes, with their golden clouds and cobalt skies, the Chinese vases on their stands, the massed velvet tumbling from the high bronze rods of the narrow old windows. I saw it all of a piece, including the bed where I had lain, now heaped with fresh, down-filled coverlets and pillowed with embroidered antique vases. And she, the center diamond of it all, in long white flannel, flounced at wrists and hem with rich old Irish lace, playing her long, lacquered grand with agile, unerring fingers, her hair a broad, smooth, yellow glow about her shoulders. I kissed her scented locks, and then her tender throat, and caught her girlish smile and gleaming glance as she played on, her head tilting back to brush my coat front. Down around her neck I slipped my arms. She leaned her gentle weight against me. With crossed arms I clasped her waist. I felt her shoulders moving against my snug embrace with her darting fingers. I dared in whisper-soft tones, with sealed lips, to hum the song, and she hummed with me. "Appassionata," I whispered in her ear. I was crying. I didn't want to touch her with blood. She was too clean, too pretty. I turned my head. She pitched forward, her hands pounded into the stormy finish. A silence fell, abrupt and crystalline as the music before it. She turned and threw her arms around me, and held me tight, and said the words I've never heard a mortal speak in all my long immortal life. "Armand, I love you." Chapter 23. Need I say they are the perfect companions? Neither of them cared about the murders. I could not for the life of me understand it. They cared about other things, such as world peace, the poor suffering homeless in the waning winter cold of New York, the price of medicines for the sick, and how dreadful it was that Israel and Palestine were forever in battle with each other. But they did not care one whit about the horrors they'd beheld with their own eyes. They did not care that I killed every night for blood, that I lived off it and nothing else, and that I was a creature wed by my very nature to human destruction. They did not care one whit about the dead brother. His name was Fox, by the way, and the last name of my beautiful child is best left unmentioned. In fact, if this text ever sees the light of the real world, you're bound to change both her first name and that of Benjamin. However, that's not my concern now. I can't think of the fate of these pages, except that they are very much for her, as I mentioned to you before, and if I'm allowed to title them, I think it will be Symphony for Cybele. Not, please understand, that I love Benji no less. It's only that I haven't the same overwhelming protective feeling for him. I know that Benji will live out a great and adventurous life, no matter what should befall me or Cybele, or even the times. It's in his flexible and enduring Bedouin nature. He is a true child of the tents and the blowing sands, though in his case the house was a dismal cinder-block hovel on the outskirts of Jerusalem, where he induced tourists to pose for overpriced pictures with him and a filthy, snarling camel. He'd been flat-out kidnapped by Fox under the felonious terms of a long-term lease of bondage, for which Fox paid Benji's father $5,000. A fabricated emigration passport was thrown into the bargain. He'd been the genius of the tribe, without doubt, had mixed feelings about going home, and had learnt in the New York streets to steal, smoke, and curse, in that order. Though he swore up and down he couldn't read, it turned out that he could, and began to do so obsessively, just as soon as I started throwing books at him. In fact, he could read English, Hebrew, and Arabic, having read all three in the newspapers of his homeland since before he could remember. He loved taking care of Cybele. He saw to it that she ate, drank milk, bathed, and changed her clothes, when none of these routine tasks interested her. He prided himself on the fact that he could, by his wits, obtain for her whatever she needed, no matter what happened to her. He was the front man for her with the hotel, tipping the maids, making normal talk at the front desk, which included remarkably fine-spun lies about the whereabouts of the dead Fox, who had become, in Benji's never-ending saga, a fabulous world traveler and amateur photographer. He handled the piano tuner, who was called as often as once a week, because the piano stood by the window, exposed to sun and cold, and also because Sibel did indeed pound it with the fury that would indeed have impressed the great Beethoven. He spoke on the phone to the bank, all of whose personnel thought he was his older brother, David, pronounced David, and then made the requisite calls at the teller's window for cash as little Benjamin. I was convinced, within nights of talking with him, that I could give him as fine an education as Marius had ever given me, and that he would end up having his choice of universities, professions, or amateur pursuits of mind-engaging substance. I didn't overplay my hand, but before the week was out, I was dreaming of boarding schools for him, from which he might emerge a gold-buttoned, blue-blazer-wearing, American East Coast social conquistador. I love him enough to tear limb from limb anyone who so much as lays a finger on him. But between me and Sibel, there lies a sympathy which sometimes eludes mortals and immortals for the space of their entire lives. I know Sibel. I know her. I knew her when I first heard her play, and I know her now. And I wouldn't be here with you if she were not under the protection of Marius. I will, during the space of Sibel's life, never be parted from her. And there is nothing she can ever ask of me that I shall not give. I will endure unspeakable anguish when Sibel inevitably dies, but that has to be borne. I have no choice now in the matter. I am not the creature I was when I laid eyes on Veronica's veil, when I stepped into the sun. I am someone else, and that someone else has fallen deeply and completely in love with Sibel and Benjamin, and I cannot go back on it. Of course, I am keenly conscious that I thrive in this love. Being happier than I have ever been in my entire immortal existence, I have gained great strength from having these two as my companions. The situation is too nearly perfect to be anything but utterly accidental. Sibel is not insane. She is nowhere near it, and I fancy that I understand her perfectly. Sibel is obsessed with one thing, and that is playing the piano. From the first time she laid her hands on the keys, she has wanted nothing else. And her career, as so generously planned for her by her proud parents and by the burningly ambitious Fox, never meant much of anything to her. Had she been poor and struggling, perhaps recognition would have been indispensable to her love affair with the piano, as it would have given her the requisite escape from life's dreary domestic traps and routines. But she was never poor. And she is truly, in the very root of her soul, indifferent as to whether people hear her play her music or not. She needs only to hear it herself, and to know that she is not disturbing other people. In the old hotel, mostly full of rooms rented by the day, with only a handful of tenants rich enough to be lodged there year by year, as was Sibel's family, she can play forever without disturbing anyone. And after her parents' tragic death, after she lost the only two witnesses who had been intimate to her development, she simply could not cooperate with Fox's plans for her career any further. Well, all this I understood, almost from the beginning. I understood it in her incessant repetition of the Sonata No. 23, and I think if you were to hear it, you would understand it too. I want you to hear it. Understand it will not at all faze Sibel if other people do gather to listen to her. It won't bother her one whit if she's recorded. If other people enjoy her playing and tell her so, she's delighted. But it's a simple thing with her. Ah, so you too love it, she thinks. Isn't it beautiful? This is what she said to me with her eyes and her smiles, the very first time I ever approached her. And I suppose before I go any further, and I do have more to put down about my children, I should address this question. How did I approach her? How did I come to be in her apartment on that fateful morning, when Dora stood in the cathedral crying to the crowds about the miraculous veil, and I, the blood in my veins having combusted, was in fact rocketing skyward? I don't know. I have rather tiresome supernatural explanations that read like tomes by members of the Society for the Study of Psychic Phenomena, or the scripts for Mulder and Scully on the television show called The X-Files, or like a secret file on the case in the archives of the Order of Psychic Detectives called the Talamasca. Bluntly, I see it this way.
I have most powerful abilities to cast spells, to dislocate my vision, and to transmit my image over distances, and to affect matter both at close range and matter which is out of sight. I must somehow, in this morning journey towards the clouds, have used this power. It might have been drawn from me in a moment of harrowing pain, when I was for all purposes deranged and completely unaware of what was happening to me. It might have been a last, desperate, hysterical refusal to accept the possibility of death, or of the horrible predicament, so close to death, in which I found myself. That is, having fallen on the roof, burnt and in unspeakable torment, I might have sought a desperate mental escape, projecting my image and my strength into Sibel's apartment long enough to kill her brother. It certainly is possible for spirits to exert enough pressure on matter to change it, so perhaps that is exactly what I did— project myself in spirit form, and lay hands upon the substance that was Fox, and kill him. But I don't really believe all this. I'll tell you why. First off, though Sibel and Benjamin are no experts, for all their savvy and seeming detachment, on the subject of death and its subsequent forensic analysis, they both insisted that Fox's body was bloodless when they got rid of it. The puncture wounds were apparent on his neck. In sum, they believe to this very hour that I was there, in substantial form, and that I did indeed drink Fox's blood. Now that a projected image cannot do, at least not insofar as I know it. No, it cannot devour the blood of an entire circulatory system, and then dissolve itself, returning to the cicatricula of the mind from which it came. No, that is not possible. Of course, Sibel and Benji could be wrong. What do they know about blood and bodies? But the fact is, they let Fox lie there, quite dead, for some 2 days, or so they said, while they waited for the return of the Dybbuk or Angel, whom they were sure would help them. Now in that time, the blood of a human body sinks down to the very lowest part of the carcass, and such a change would have been visible to these children. They noted no such thing. Ah, it makes my brain ache. The fact is, I don't know how I got to their apartment, or why. I don't know how it happened. And I do know, as I have already said, that as regards the entire experience, everything I saw and felt in the great restored cathedral at Kiev, an impossible place, was as real as what I knew in Sibel's apartment. There is one other small point, and though it is small, it is crucial. After I had slain Fox, Benji did see my burnt body falling from the sky. He did see me just as I saw him from the window. There is one very terrible possibility. It is this. I was going to die that morning. It was going to happen. My ascent was driven by immense will and an immense love of God, of which I have no doubt as I dictate these words now. But perhaps at the crucial moment, my courage failed me. My body failed me, and seeking some refuge from the sun, some way to thwart my martyrdom, I struck upon the predicament of Sibel and her brother, and feeling her great need of me, I commenced to fall towards the shelter of the roof, on which the snow and ice quickly covered me. My visit to Sibel could have been, according to this interpretation, only a passing illusion, a powerful projection of self, as I've said, a wish fulfillment of the need of this random and vulnerable girl about to be fatally beaten by her brother. As for Fox, I killed him, without doubt. But he died from fear, from failure of the heart, perhaps, from the pressure of my illusory hands on his fragile throat, from the power of telekinesis or suggestion. But as I stated before, I don't believe this. I was there in the cathedral in Kiev. I broke the egg with my thumbs. I saw the bird fly free. I know my mother stood at my side, and I know that my father knocked over the chalice. I know because I know there is no part of me that could have imagined such a thing. And I know, too, because the colors I saw then and the music I heard were not made up of anything I had ever experienced. Now there is simply no other dream I have ever had about which I can say this. When I said the Mass in Vladimir's city, I was in a realm made up of ingredients which my imagination simply does not have at its disposal. I don't want to say any more about it. It's too hurtful and awful to try to analyze it. I didn't will it, not with my conscious heart, and I had no conscious power over it. It simply happened. I would, if I could, forget it entirely.
I am so extraordinarily happy with Sibelle and Benji that surely I want to forget it all for the space of their lifetimes. I want only to be with them, as I have been since the night I described to you. As you realize, I took my time in coming here. Having returned to the ranks of the dangerous undead, it was very easy for me to discern from the roaming minds of other vampires that Lestat was safe in his prison here, and indeed was dictating to you the entire story of what had happened to him with God incarnate and with Memnoch the devil. It was very easy for me to discern, without revealing my own presence, that an entire world of vampires mourned for me with greater anguish and tears than I could ever have predicted. So, being confident of Lestat's safety, being baffled yet relieved by the mysterious fact that his stolen eye had been returned to him, I was at leisure to stay with Sibelle and Benji, and I did so. With Benji and Sibelle, I rejoined the world in a way which I had not done since my fledgling, my one and only fledgling, Daniel Malloy, had left me. My love for Daniel had never been entirely honest, and always viciously possessive, and quite entangled with my own hatred of the world at large, and my confusion in the face of the baffling modern times which had begun to open up to me when I emerged in the late years of the 18th century from the catacombs beneath Paris. Daniel himself had no use for the world, and had come to me hungering for our dark blood, his brain swimming with macabre, grotesque tales which Louis de Point du Lac had told him. Heaping every luxury upon him, I only sickened him with mortal sweets, so that finally he turned away from the riches I offered, becoming a vagabond. Mad, roaming the streets in rags, he shut out the world almost to the point of death, and I, weak, muddled, tormented by his beauty, and lusting for the living man, and not the vampire he might become, only brought him over to us through the working of the dark trick, because he would have died otherwise. I was no Marius to him afterwards. It was too exactly as I supposed. He loathed me in his heart for having initiated him into living death, for having made him in one night both an immortal and a regular killer. As a mortal man, he had no real idea of the price we pay for what we are, and he did not want to learn the truth. He fled from it in reckless dreams and spiteful wandering. And so it was as I feared. Making him to be my mate, I made a minion who saw me all the more clearly as a monster. There was never any innocence for us. There was never any springtime. There was never any chance, no matter how beautiful the twilight gardens in which we wandered. Our souls were out of tune, our desires crossed, and our resentments too common and too well watered for the final flowering. It's different now. For 2 months I remained in New York with Sibelle and Benji, living as I've never lived before, not since those long-ago nights with Marius in Venice. Sibelle is rich, as I think I've told you, but only in a tedious, struggling sort of way, with an income that pays for her exorbitant apartment and daily room-service meals, with a margin for fine clothes, tickets to the symphony, and an occasional spending spree. I am fabulously rich, so the first thing I did, with pleasure, was lavish upon Sibelle and Benjamin all the riches I had once lavished upon Daniel Malloy, to much greater effect. They loved it. Sibelle, when she was not playing the piano, had no objections whatsoever to wandering to the picture shows with Benji and me, or to the symphony and the opera. She loved the ballet, and loved to take Benjamin to the finest restaurants, where he became a regular marvel to the waiters, with his crisp, enthusiastic little voice, and his lilting way of rattling off the names of dishes, French or Italian, and ordering vintage wines which they poured for him unquestioningly, despite all the good-intentioned laws that prohibit the serving of such strong spirits to children. I loved all this, too, of course, and was delighted to discover that Sibelle also took a sporadic and playful interest in dressing me, in choosing jackets, shirts, and such, from racks, with a quick point of her finger, and in picking out for me from velvet trays all kinds of jeweled rings, cufflinks, neck chains, and tiny crucifixes of rubies and gold, solid gold clips for money, and that sort of thing. It was I who had played this masterly game with Daniel Malloy. Sibelle plays it with me in her own dreamy way, as I take care of the tiresome cash register details. I, in turn, have the supreme pleasure of carrying Benji about like a doll, and getting him to wear all the Western finery I purchase, at least now and then, for an hour or two. We make a striking trio, the three of us, dining at Lutice or Sparks. Of course, I don't dine. Benji in his immaculate little desert robe, or got up in a finely fitted little suit with narrow lapels, white button-down shirt and flash of tie. Me in my highly acceptable antique velvet and chokers of old crumbling lace. And Sibel in the lovely dresses that spill endlessly out of her closet, confections her mother and Fox once bought for her, close cut around her large breasts and small waist, and always flaring magically about her long legs, hem high enough to reveal the splendid curve of her calf and its tautness when she slips her dark stockinged feet into dagger-heeled slippers. Benji's close-cropped cap of curls is always the Byzantine halo for his dark, enigmatic little face. Her flowing waves are free, and my hair is the Renaissance mop again of long, unruly curls that used to be my secret vanity. My deepest pleasure with Benji is education. Right off, we started having powerful conversations about history and the world, and found ourselves stretched out on the carpet of the apartment, poring over maps, as we discussed the entire progress of East and West, and the inevitable influences upon human history of climate, culture, and geography. Benji gabbles away all during television broadcasts of the news, calling each anchor person intimately by his or her first name, slamming his fist in anger at the actions of world leaders, and wailing loudly over the deaths of great princesses and humanitarians. Benji can watch the news, talk steadily, eat popcorn, smoke a cigarette, and sing intermittently with Sibel's playing, always on key, all more or less simultaneously. If I fall to staring at the rain as if I've seen a ghost, it's Benji who beats on my arm and cries, "What shall we do, Armand? We have three splendid movies to see tonight. I'm vexed, I tell you, vexed. Because if we go to any of these, we'll miss Pavarotti at the Met, and I'll go pasty white with sickness." Many times the two of us dress Sibel, who looks as if she doesn't know what we're doing. We always sit talking with her when she bathes, because if we don't, she's likely to go to sleep in the bathtub, or simply stay in there for hours, sponging the water over her beautiful breasts. Sometimes the only words she says all night are things like, "Benji, tie your shoes," or, "Armand, he's stolen the silverware, make him put it back," or, with sudden astonishment, "It's warm, isn't it?" I have never told anyone my life story as I've told it to you here and now, but in conversations with Benji, I've caught myself telling him many things which Marius told me, about human nature and the history of the law, about painting, and even about music. It was in these conversations, more than in anything else, that I came to realize in the last 2 months that I was a changed being. Some stifling dark terror is gone from me. I do not see history as a panorama of disasters, as once I think I did, and often I find myself remembering Marius's generous and beautifully optimistic predictions, that the world is ever improving, that war, for all the strife we see around us, has nevertheless gone out of fashion with those in power, and will soon pass from the arenas of the Third World as it has passed from the arenas of the West. And we will truly feed the hungry, and shelter the homeless, and take care of those who need love. With Sibel, education and discussion are not the substance of our love. With Sibel, it is intimacy. I don't care if she never says anything. I don't go inside her mind. She doesn't want anybody to do that. As completely as she accepts me and my nature, I accept her and her obsession with the Appassionata. Hour after hour, night after night, I listen to Sibel play, and with each fresh start I hear the minute changes of intensity and expression which pour forth in her playing. Gradually, on account of this, I have become the only listener of whom Sibel has ever been conscious. Gradually I have become part of Sibel's music. I am there with her and the phrases and movements of the Appassionata. I am there, and I am one who has never asked anything of Sibel, except that she do what she wants to do, and what she can do so perfectly. That's all Sibel ever has to do for me, is what she will. If or when she wants to rise in fortune and men's eyes, I'll clear the way for her. If or when she wants to be alone, she will not see or hear me. If or when she wants anything, I will get it for her. and if or when she loves a mortal man or mortal woman, I'll do what she wants me to do. I can live in the shadows. Doting on her, I can live forever in gloom, because there is no gloom when I am near her. Sibel often goes with me when I hunt. Sibel likes to see me feed and kill. I don't think I have ever allowed a mortal to do that. She tries to help me dispose of the remains, or confuse the evidence of the cause of death, but I'm very strong and swift and capable at this, so she is mostly the witness. I try to avoid taking Benji on these escapades, because he becomes wildly and childishly excited, and it does him no good. To Sibel, it simply does nothing. There are other things I could tell you. How we handled the details of her brother's disappearance, how I transferred immense sums of money into her name and set up the appropriate and unbreakable trust funds for Benji, how I bought for her a substantial interest in the hotel in which she lives, and have put into her apartment, which is very huge for a hotel apartment, several other fine pianos which she enjoys, and how I have set aside for myself, a safe distance from the apartment, a lair with a coffin which is unfindable, unbreachable, and indestructible, and to which I go on occasion, though I am more accustomed to sleeping in the little chamber they first gave to me, in which velvet curtains have been fitted tightly over the one window to the airwell. But to hell with all that. You know what I want you to know. What remains for us but to bring it to the moment, to sunset on this night when I came here, entering the very den of the vampires with my brother and with my sister, one on either side, to see Lestat at last. Chapter 24. This is all a little too simple, isn't it? I mean by that my transformation from the zealous child who stood on the porch of the cathedral to the happy monster making up his mind one spring night in New York City that it was time to journey south and look in on his old friend. You know why I came here. Let me begin at the start of this evening. You were there in the chapel when I arrived. You greeted me with undisguised goodwill, so pleased to see I was alive and unharmed. Louis almost wept. Those others, those raggedy young ones who were clustered about, two boys, I believe, and a girl. I don't know who they were, and still don't, only that later they drifted off. I was horrified to see him undefended, lying on the floor, and his mother, Gabrielle, far off in the corner, merely staring at him, coldly, the way she stares at everything and everyone, as though she never knew a human feeling for what it was. I was horrified that the young tramps were about, and felt instantly protective of Sibel and Benji. I had no fear of their seeing the classics among us, the legends, the warriors, you, beloved